This is Local Talk on KHOI. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. And last week, a report entitled Fooling Ourselves was released by the Environmental Working Group. This report documents changes in the use of two important conservation practices in eight important watersheds across Iowa. Given the efforts that have been made in recent years to clean up our waters through better conservation practices and the publicity these efforts have enjoyed, what the Environmental Working Group found is rather shocking. Now, Environmental Working Group is a national organization focused on the environmental consequences of various parts of modern life on people's health. EWG has its headquarters in D.C., but because it does a lot of work on agriculture, it has its Midwest office here in Ames. So I asked the Midwest director, Craig Cox, to come over to the studio the other day. He brought his assistant, Soren Rundquist, who did much of the work on the study. Here, Craig Cox describes the basic study question of their research.
The big question that's being asked is, you know, traditionally we've relied on this so-called voluntary approach, where we have money available, cost-share dollars available for landowners, and they volunteer to change their farming practices or land use in one way or another, and the taxpayer shares part of the cost. We've been doing that since, you know, the 1930s. And the question is it working? Is it going to work? Can we rely on that approach to clean up Iowa's waterways? And, you know, in the last, since 2005, just in the federal USDA programs, we've spent $3 billion in Iowa. So why aren't we seeing more improvement? Why isn't water quality better, even though we've had that, you know, really substantial investment? And what we had seen in just driving around Iowa in the Midwest is it seemed like these conservation practices blinked on and off, that a practice would be applied, but that didn't mean it was going to stay, that it could disappear. And we decided to take a harder look at that, a more quantitative look at that, by focusing on eight watersheds that had been selected as priorities for the nutrient reduction strategy and use aerial imagery to track what happened to two particular conservation practices. And I'll let Soren pick it up from there.
Okay, Soren Rundquist.
Yeah, so as Craig stated, we deployed aerial photography to monitor the existence of two practices, grass waterways and buffers along streams and rivers. And in these eight watersheds, it was rather interesting when in the course of 4 years between 2011 to 2014, we saw for buffers a decrease in net acres and a meager gain in total miles of grass waterways installed. If you look specifically at the numbers, we found within that 4 years, there were numerous instances where producers had installed riparian buffers, 45 acres went in. However, in that same time period, there were around 119 acres taken out. Approximately, you know, 74 acres were lost in net if you factor in what went in and what came out. While some producers took steps to put buffers in, more buffers were taking out, leaving a net loss of 74 acres within 75 feet of the shoreline. And then for grass waterways, we saw an increase where producers installed 26 miles of grass waterways directly on cultivated fields to filter and slow down water coming off those fields. And at the same time, there were 21 miles of grass waterways taken out, leaving a positive gain of 5 miles. But, you know, within 3 years and billions of dollars spent, you know, 5 miles is relatively little change. So those findings really, really enforced what we were seeing driving around the landscape, that while many producers are voluntarily putting in these practices, many are voluntarily taking them off the landscape, thus essentially leaving taxpayers to absorb all the cost of implementation and and really seeing no progress in terms of lasting conservation on the landscape.
A few questions come to mind. First of all, just so our audience knows what we're talking about, grass waterways would be kind of installing a strip of grass where you might otherwise just have a gully in a farm field because that's the way the water tends to flow?
That's correct, yeah. So using high-resolution data inputs, specifically a product called LIDAR, which measures it's a laser that's shot at the Earth's surface, and the time calculated to bounce that laser back to the sensor calculates the actual, you know, within centimeters, the elevation of the surface. So using those data, EWG was able to model how water flows off the landscape and thus target, you know, those specific instances where grass waterways would be
beneficial.
Beneficial, exactly.
Yeah.
And also quantitatively assess, does a grass waterway exist, you know, in an area that's highly susceptible to
right.
runoff directly on the field.
And that would be great data for other organizations to have, too. Like,
of course,
you
yeah.
know, the Soil and Water Conservation District
And it's freely available. It's, you know, largely produced and maintained by state and federal governments. And, yeah, you have to have a little know-how in terms of how to ingest and use the data. But, you know, there's a plethora of good information in there that can be deployed to do studies just like this.
So this is satellite data, not plane flying data.
The LIDAR would be a plane.
Oh.
It's a radar, more or less, shooting a signal at the Earth. And then the data we use to validate whether a vegetative practice, being a buffer or a grass waterway, existed were aerial photography. So that was flown by a plane too. Satellites are very useful if you're doing larger scale studies because they can cover a lot more ground. However, your resolution is more coarse and you lose a lot more precision, especially if you're monitoring a small space of 75 feet. You're not going to be able to do an assessment that accurate with most satellites.
Okay. So we got straight into the wonky part.
I can go on and put people to sleep.
But this data, just to clarify, is already available
and these data are also a freely available resource maintained and provided by the U.S. Department of Agriculture called the acronym is NAIP, N-A-I-P, the National Agricultural Imagery Program. And they, in most states in the Corn Belt, they will fly 1 meter resolution photography for the entire state, usually annually.
Hmm.
So it's a great resource, and it's a great resource to track progress because you have a nice catalog of high resolution photography to monitor. You know, are these practices disappearing every year, every other year? Are they staying for 10 years?
That's very interesting. So I guess the big question is why? Why do we see farmers putting in and taking out? I'm sure corn prices have to have something major to do with that. Is there any other reason that, in terms of policy, that farmers are taking land out when they know that water quality is important to Iowans and that there's a major push to improve the water quality through conservation measures?
Well, I can tell you what farmers have told me. That I've asked landowners and farmers what they think is happening. And I get three answers almost all the time. One is that so much of the land is not owned by the person who's farming. Like in Iowa, over half of the cropland is leased to the farmer, not owned by the farmer. So a lot of time the farmer, the person actually farming the land, doesn't have as much to say about what happens on the land they're farming that you'd think they would have. So I've heard lots of stories from farmers about, you know, disagreement on what the best way to farm that land that they're leasing. And, of course, most of this land is now rented, you know, cash rent on an annual basis. And frankly, you know, farmers have told me that some of those landowners are way more interested in the cash. In fact, that's about all they're interested in is in the cash. So in some cases, conservation-minded farmers are put in a bind. by, you know, whatever the attitudes of the landowner are. The second thing I've been told is that this was especially true during the big price boom, is that farmers were expanding the number of acres they were farming. So remember, there's a pretty narrow window in which you can plant.
In terms of time.
In terms of time. So if they were going to be able to farm successfully these larger acres, they had to have bigger equipment. And the bigger equipment needs bigger fields, right? So they saw a lot of fields being expanded mm-hmm. in size. And, of course, if you're using big equipment, it both slows you down and is harder to drive around these conservation practices. So they've told me that they saw a lot of these practices go out as these field sizes were expanded and operations were bigger and had to get their work done faster, and maintaining these practices is inconvenient, gets in the way. And then the third thing they, you know, the farmers I talked to almost always mentioned was Roundup, that you really have to slow down unless you have some really state-of-the-art equipment to make sure your spray doesn't drift over onto the grass strips that are planted along the stream bank, or, you know, especially the ones that are planted in the middle of the field, the grass waterways. So those are the three reasons that farmers themselves have suggested to me that they think was driving the changes we see on the landscape.
Wow. And those are all related to other trends that have come into farming, the increase of the use of land as an investment,
the
further distancing of the landowner from the activity of farming,
that's right.
The tenant-farmer system where that has been on the rise. And then you mentioned the price boom, but with the price boom, you know, people are expanding operation, changing the financing of their system.
That's right.
Putting big money into big machines, expecting that in return. And then the Roundup, which has just come to dominate the agricultural practices since the introduction of Roundup Ready corn, after the introduction of Roundup Ready soybeans in the last decade or so, just overtaking all other forms of farming.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, I think the world has really changed in farm country. And I think our public policy is not keeping up. And we're thinking that the way we used to try to get conservation on the ground 30 years ago is still going to work in today's farming world. And I think, you know, the Fooling Ourselves report that we just released is just one little indication that, you know, business as usual is just not going to get the job done anymore.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, and we are listening to my interview with Craig Cox, Midwest Director of Environmental Working Group, about a new study the organization released called Fooling Ourselves, Voluntary Programs Fail to Clean Up Dirty Water, which has demonstrated that despite the emphasis on water quality and nutrient reduction in Iowa, more conservation acres are being taken out of the eight Iowa watersheds they studied then are being put in. So I asked Craig Cox about how federal conservation funding levels were affecting the process. I recalled that in the 1990s, the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP, was a big deal. This had been instituted in the 1985 Farm Bill, and by this practice, taxpayers essentially rented farmers' land to install 10-year conservation practices on them. I knew, actually, from visiting the town hall in Tama on Tuesday that conservation dollars had been cut in the 2014 Farm Bill, as, in fact, they had been cut in previous Farm Bills. That certainly affected the results. And, in fact, the researchers at EWG found that 80% of the riparian buffers they saw taken out had formerly been CRP lands. Iowa once had 2.3 million acres of CRP. It now has 1.6 million acres. But more important than the CRP program, said Cox, was another federal program, also instituted in the 1985 Farm Bill, known as Conservation Cross Compliance. And this program requires proper management of vulnerable land, either marshlands or highly erodible land, if the farmers want to be eligible for federal crop subsidies. Other farmers who don't have vulnerable land are automatically eligible for these subsidies. But if you are a landowner, a farmer who happens to farm land that is highly erodible, then you would, in order to get the subsidies for your crops, you would have to visit your NRCS office and get a plan and execute the plan, do everything the plan says, that the conservationist says must be done to help that land stay in place. So that particular program, and Craig Cox called it a quid pro quo. In other words, you have to do this conservation every year in order for you to get this subsidy every year. And this one affects 11.5 million acres in Iowa compared to the 1 or 2 million in CRP. So, in fact, in the 2014 Farm Bill, this quid pro quo requirement was actually expanded to taxpayer subsidies for crop insurance, which is absolutely essential for farmers to operate. Taxpayers currently pay two-thirds of farmers' insurance payments. And so this was considered a win for conservation. The problem is, says Cox, the enforcement is poor.
In the conservation compliance world, there had to be significant enforcement. You know, USDA actually had to go out and inspect. But enforcement has become very lax. You know, a lot of farmers have told me it's a joke now. I mean, no one pays attention.
So Cox is hopeful that this relatively new aerial photography and aerial data that enabled his study will also allow NRCS agents to pay closer attention to what farmers are doing. And, of course, there's climate change. Cox mentioned that the rains come hard. They come often in the spring or even early winter, as we saw this year, when the fields are bare and most vulnerable. All of these factors contribute to his thesis that the practice of farming has changed and policy has not kept up. So I asked Craig Cox of EWG what kind of change they were advocating for.
What we are advocating for is what we call a basic standard of care, that there should be a set of conventional, fairly simple conservation measures that we think landowners should be expected to have in place, whether or not there's taxpayer assistance to apply and maintain those practices. So we don't want every farmer to have a EPA permit or a Iowa DNR permit, but we think there's some activities that are really disproportionately damaging, and we think landowners ought to be responsible to heal or to end those practices. So the big four that we've thrown out to get the conversation started is you ought to have at least 50 feet of grass or other permanent vegetation between cropland and waterways in order to filter the runoff that's coming off your cropland in entering waterways. The ephemeral gullies that you talked about, they ought to be healed. There ought to be a grass strip on those gullies, or there's other measures that can be taken to interrupt that flow. We think you should at least be managing to some extent the access of livestock to streams. You know, those hooves as the livestock goes in and out of the stream can really beat up those stream banks. And we know that erosion from streams and stream banks is a huge source of phosphorus and sediment in Iowa and across the Midwest. We're not saying you have to exclude the cattle completely, but, you know, at least harden the bank where they're going in and out of the water. And finally, you know, applying manure on frozen or snow-covered ground is just, it's not a good practice. And, you know, in the springtime when it's snowmelt or we get heavy spring rains before the ground is, you know, while the ground is still frozen, it's just a disaster. So those four things won't solve every problem in Iowa. It won't get us all the way to the goals in the nutrient reduction strategy, but it would really make a big difference. And then we could use the increasingly scarce dollars for voluntary programs. You know, they could come into play on top of that basic standard of care and help people go way beyond that, you know, meeting those basic requirements. So that's what we think would finally get us closer to really lasting, enduring progress cleaning up Iowa's water.
Well, I like the language, basic standard of care. I mean, we expect that for children, for instance. You know, parents have to do a certain amount of care, and so it should be for our land.
If you look around the states, there's pieces of this basic standard of care already in place in a number of states. Even in Iowa, there's already regulations about when and how manure can be applied to frozen and snow-covered ground. So it's not as far-fetched as I think sometimes it gets portrayed. And you know, I think a lot of farmers, if they were tasked with coming up with their list of what ought to be expected of landowners, based on my conversations, I think a lot of them would come up with a similar list because, you know, they know it's planting your corn in the stream, that's not good business. You know, gullies all over your fields, that's not good business. And it's not good for agriculture's brand either. So I think if you pulled farmers together county by county and asked them to come up with a basic standard of care, I think they'd come up with a good standard.
Maybe if you separated the farmers from their advocacy groups, you'd have a better chance of success.
Yeah.
Anything else that we haven't touched on yet about this report, Fooling Ourselves, on the conservation practices, 2011-2014?
I would briefly add that we're not starting from zero. You know, in some cases, you know, we did a study last year titled Low-Hanging Fruit where we actually monitored the buffer existence, you know, in five counties throughout Iowa. And some counties had more than 75% of riparian buffer in existence. So, you know, we're not starting from scratch on this. And, you know, in most cases, you know, farmers already have these. You know, we're trying to single out the bad actors that, you know, could use a little more conservation on the landscape.
It's part of the mystery that we've seen, even in the aerial imagery that Soren has been analyzing, is, you know, one farmer will just be doing a fabulous job of conservation on that piece of ground. And then, you know, across the fence, it's a completely different story, right? So why? Why can this one landowner or farmer be doing all of this stuff to clean up Iowa's water and the neighbor isn't? Why? And I think that's part of what is mysterious to us, that shows that, you know, you can do these practices, you can stay in business, you can thrive, and yet some folks are on board and a lot of folks aren't.
Yeah. And with the basic standard of care, this would also completely erase the first problem that you mentioned, which is that landowners may not be farming the land themselves and may put restrictions in the place of farmers who, you know, might prefer to do things the right way. If they're required, there's no discussion.
That's exactly right. And I think this big change in who's farming the land versus who owns the land is a major reason why we need a basic standard of care. It's because we need some responsibility put on those landowners, you know, not just the farmers. And until those landowners do have some responsibility, I think we're still going to be struggling to, you know, to do what needs to be done.
Well, thank you very much, Craig Cox of Environmental Working Group. He's the Midwest Director and Senior VP. And Soren Rundquist, researcher for the group. Did you go to Iowa State?
I'm a Hawkeye, fortunately.
Oh, them's fighting words. Okay. Well,
everything you said is no longer believed by anybody.
No credibility.
Did you grow up among farmers?
I did. I grew up in Northwest Iowa in Sioux City. So, yeah, I know. My great-great-grandpa, farmed in eastern Nebraska. And, growing up, all my friends, most of them came from farms. So we're asking for, a healthy balance for the environment. And we're asking for a lot of practical things that most people could get behind, whether you're farming the land or driving by.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Again, that was Craig Cox and Soren Rundquist of Environmental Working Group. They have their office right there on Duff Avenue and 6th.